So today's piece, actually, we're going to look in detail at right speech. Each of the parts of the Eightfold Path have the word right in front of them. And a couple of weeks ago, we investigated what that means, and some of that will come into this today. Actually, right speech is part of a grouping in the Eightfold Path. Right speech, right action, right livelihood. This group is often called the moral discipline, which is, that sounds quite scary, doesn't it? So before we delve into right speech, we'll have a look at the group first and what we're talking about here. And I think it's fair to notice that they are placed immediately after right view and right intent. And for those of you that were here for the first couple of weeks, you'll know I've driven this parallel with a journey. So you've got a right view, which you can describe as your destination. That's where you want to get to. Right intent are the various turns that you choose to take to actually get there. And some of them could be wrong. You know, you end up going back the way you came. But the fact is that actually any journey that's worthwhile undertaking is probably going to be quite long, and we need to take some stuff with us, you know, otherwise we might get hungry on the way or thirsty, and a map might be handy. So this particular moral group, if you like, you can think of as the things you might like to take with you on your journey, and the things you want to leave behind. And if you recall, one aspect of that word right that we explored was asking the simple question, whenever we undertake any action or any thought or any decision, is it wholesome? That was the key driver. Is this particular activity that we're undertaking wholesome or unwholesome to ourselves and to others? There are many damaging thoughts and there are many wholesome thoughts. So again, actually with the morality group, that's how we can approach it. Hello, Zizi. Don't worry, just relax. We're looking at right speech today. Okay. And, of course, just the same as the first two, actually, what we're investigating here is the mental activity around this. Everything in Buddhist practice stems from mental activity. That's the real concentration. And it's an interesting one. Here in the West, you know, morality and ethics, they're often seen as kind of ways to adhere to rules. Or perhaps some higher power or office, or even a deity. This isn't the focus in Buddhism, and it's a key aspect. And I think, you know, for some people, this is why coming to Buddhism is so tricky, because there aren't rules. The first time I encountered this kind of situation outside of Buddhism was when Denise and I went Argentine tango dancing. And I wasn't the only bloke there, surprisingly. There were a bunch of other blokes. And the first thing that our teacher, Steve, said was, well, first of all, there's no formal steps in Argentine tango. It's an approach. It's a spirit, you know. And all us blokes were looking at each other going, oh, I don't know what to do now. And it was like rabbits in headlights, you know. We wanted the rules. We wanted the steps. I put my foot here. None of that. But actually, it's a lovely dance once you kind of get to grips with it. Because of that lack of rule setting, you just flow. In many ways, Buddhist practice is very much like this. So although we've got this morality group here, it's not a set of rules. So it's quite tricky in that respect. But it is a key and important practice of the Eightfold Path. And Buddha actually said, first establish yourself in the starting point of wholesome states. That is in a purified moral discipline and in right view. Then, when your moral discipline is purified and your view straight, you practice the foundations of mindfulness. So, you know, he really put it up there in lights, this particular group. And also, there's an interesting word here, discipline. and of course, all sorts of connotations come up then, don't they? And particularly in the West here, because we have our rules, if we break them, we get disciplined. Again, it's not talking about that. You know, here, we're talking about the self-discipline. And anyone that's come to the practice of meditation very quickly discovers, actually, if you haven't got some self-discipline, you're just not going to make progress. So you do have to practice self-discipline. It is about practice. None of us have got it at the start. You know, when we're 3 years old, we're not exactly disciplined individuals. It's about practicing. And as we said before, we can say that in a nutshell, the teachings can be summarized as abstaining from the unskillful and cultivating the skillful. In this way, we purify the mind. That makes sense. Okay, so first of all, right speech. This is the area we're going to look at today. And there's a really good way, actually, and it's coming up in the Sangha House, to investigate right speech. In Buddhism, we have the practice of the noble silence, okay? And noble silence traditionally has two levels, actually. You have the five-star silence, noble five-star, and noble seven-star silence. Five-star silence is the one we're going to do in the house. It's the one I really believe has merit and benefit. And in five-star silence, we avoid speaking, and that's all we do. So eye contact allowed, a good old hug, a laugh.
A laugh?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, right.
Yeah, you can have a laugh. Absolutely. No, you can have a laugh. You can have a good old giggle if you want.
I didn't realise.
Yes, absolutely.
Any kind of gesture?
Yeah, gesture. Obviously, you know, skillful gestures, not unskillful ones. And you can, you know, theoretically, you can write each other notes if you get desperate, only you should avoid that because it's another form of speech. So the clue here is it's about speech. Okay? Seven-star noble silence, eyes downcast, no contact whatsoever. Very, very different. The two have a key difference in them. Five-star noble silence is about connecting more deeply with the world and the people around us. Seven-star is actually going inward. Okay? For me as a Buddhist, part of my practice that's really become important to me is that connection element, which is why five star is so important. The reason it works is because when we withhold speech, we notice the thoughts that are coming into our mind that we would normally go bleh and put out there. So we actually mentally start holding ourselves back, and therefore we pay attention to the thoughts that usually contribute to speech. And therefore, it's an opportunity to explore right speech, because this is what it's all about. It's the mental processes as it go around it. So you kind of bite the words back and you look at the thinking behind them. And what it reveals to us is the real motivation, the intent behind the words. And then we can look at those motivations and the intent and ask ourselves, is that wholesome? Is it skillful? Or is it unwholesome? What we discover are different types of speech, obviously. And the first one is, of course, true or false speech. Okay, the connotations here are obvious, but the motivations will always be more complex. So to investigate what's driving our speech is really key here. You know, we can start to delve into the nature of the message we're offering out or about to offer out and ask ourselves whether it's truthful. Some of this is very, very obvious. Some of this practice can be really challenging. Our modern world actually sometimes places pressures on us to be less than truthful. This really came to a head for me in my previous career when I was in IT. And it's one of the reasons I stepped out of it, because I was coming under more and more pressure to actually not tell the customers the truth. And when I challenged this with my bosses and said I was struggling with it, the answer I got was, "Oh no, don't worry. Don't worry, Andy. It's not lying. You're just spinning. That's what you're doing. You're spinning the message. It's important to learn the difference and to learn to spin the message." And I'm sorry, but I didn't agree. And we all have these kind of challenges in our lives today. We're it's very hard. So I would encourage this approach of looking at the thinking behind the speech, the potential speech, and questioning whether it's actually wholesome to yourself. Okay? Yes, apply the thought process about others, definitely. But also, it's important. Are we damaging ourselves, actually, with what we're about to see? And keep things simple. Do not try and solve the problems of the world and struggle with it. Don't overcomplicate. Life is complicated enough. Look at the direct question. Is this wholesome to me and to others? There's a deep implication about truth. We as humans, we affect the world every time we reach out and touch it. And one major way we do this is through speech. So if our speech is unwholesome in some way, shape or form, we're touching the world with that act. So the Buddha always encouraged us to tread lightly on the world. So that's what we have to learn to do with our speech. Unwholesome touch, unwholesome speech permeates like oil polluted into a river. It might feel like little droplets of oil at first, but if we all go putting it in there, you can bet the river's going to die after a while. The second area is harsh speech. And this is speech which is uttered in anger, and it's driven by aversion. Generally, we have aversion to something which, in the deepest sense, could be fear. Often, what's sitting under the surface of fear, of anger, is fear. It's usually driven by that in some way, shape, or form. Angry people will have trouble admitting that, but it's sitting there, you can guarantee it. So again, if we're about to utter harsh speech, we must investigate the nature of what's going on underneath, what is driving it. And it can be born out of just a simple lack of care. In other words, we utter something that may cause harm because we've spoken without considering the consequences. We can't see the consequences of all our thoughts and therefore our speech, but we should at least try. And as I've said before, one of the aims of a Buddhist when we wake up in the morning is to say to ourselves, "Today I'm not going to cause harm, either physically, emotionally, intellectually, financially, any type of harm. It's the one thing I'll always fail at, Because even to avoid causing harm to one person, I'll harm somebody else. And remember, there is a third, another person in all of this, and that's us. We mustn't cause ourselves harm. We are equally as important as everybody else. That's really important. We put ourselves up there with everybody else. So when we're thinking about our actions and whether they're harmful or not, we have to ask ourselves, yes, is it harming others? But by avoiding harming others, am I actually harming myself? Am I doing myself damage? We have to consider that as well. So, fairly obvious on the surface, more tricky underneath. Idle chatter. It's an interesting one, this. We often read here that speech should only be used for matters which carry purpose or depth. Personally, I find this a bit hard to follow, actually. I think most marriages would grow pretty stale if the couple could only discuss things that were of serious, deep nature. That would be pretty sad, actually. But there's one key area that I think is really important with idle chatter. Gossip. It's really important and it causes such a lot of damage. And this definitely sits in here. So we say something about someone who isn't actually present to somebody else. And it might be because we believe it'll put us in a position of power. Or maybe it just fills the silence, you know. We do that a lot, don't we? There's a great story from Socrates here. He's genius, Socrates. One of his friends came up to him and said, Socrates, here, Socrates, do you know what I just heard about one of your students? Socrates replies, wait a moment. Before you tell me, I'd like you to pass a little test for me. It's called the triple filter test. Student says, triple filter? What's that? Socrates continued, before you talk to me about my student, let's take a moment to filter out what you're going to say. The first filter of truth. Have you made absolutely sure what you're about to tell me is true? Well, no, the man said. Actually, I just heard about it and I thought it'd be useful for you to know. Hold up. So you don't actually know if it's true or not. Well, now we try the second filter, the filter of goodness. Is what you're about to tell me about my student something that's good? And the student goes, no, no, absolutely not. On the contrary, what? Socrates says. So, let me get this straight. You don't know it's true, and what you're about to tell me is something that's bad, even though you're not certain it's true. The man shrugged a little, a bit embarrassed now. He's starting to get a clue of where this is going. And Socrates said to him, but you may still pass the test, because there's a third filter, the filter of usefulness. Is what you're about to tell me about my student going to be useful to me? And the student says, nah, not really. Well, concluded Socrates, if you want to tell me and it's neither true nor good nor useful, why bother telling me at all? Fantastic story about gossip. So, right speech. Any questions, any thoughts?
Nope. Did you say something about being skillful? Don't do it unless you're skillful?
Yeah.
How can you be skillful until you've practiced? You know, you get skillful by practicing.
That's a good question. Yeah. Well, I think certainly our skillfulness will improve, but I think by skillful there are certain things that we intuitively know as human beings are skillful or unskillful. I think even when we're born, a little toddler that takes another toddler's toy, there's a definite gleam in that toddler's eye. They kind of intuitively know. I saw it with my daughter, actually. It was a beautiful episode. She was very young, probably about 5. I was in the back garden and her mum then was in the front. And little Charlie comes wandering out, big beaming smile, and says, "Mummy says I can have a biscuit." I looked and said, "Oh, okay. Well, let's go through and have a look at this. So come with me." So we walked through to the front garden. I looked at Mum and I said, "Charlie says that you said she could have a biscuit." Charlie's looking at me, absolutely shocked. And Mum says, "No, I never said that." And I looked at Charlie and she said, "Yes, Daddy, but I didn't want you to ask Mummy that question." Absolutely perfect. She was developing the art of lying there, early stages. She knew it was wrong. So I think, yes, our skillfulness does increase, but there are certain things that we definitely know for sure right at the start. And actually, if you look at some of the things that we cause harm with, like not telling lies, not taking things that aren't given, those we know. And those are the easy ones, and we find ourselves doing them. So, actually, it's not so difficult. And that's why I say about let's not overcomplicate things. Let's keep it simple. The group of moral discipline, is pop those up there first, because actually they're the right fruit to pick. If we're happy to be disciplined about it, we can at least sort that out first before we get on to the more difficult stuff. Yeah.
You're saying about the truth. Some of the PR people, what they've got is a little vein of truth, greatly exaggerated. Where would you put this amongst the right speech?
Yeah, so again, I think you don't overcomplicate this stuff. You know, if those...
It's like that's some of the worst lying.
Yeah, exactly.
The person can't defend against that because there's a little vein of truth.
So, supermarket packaging. We talk about this in the Restart program and nutritional advice on food labels. Okay. So, you pick up a yogurt and it's one of these big tubs of yogurt and it says in there... let's say it's a 500 gram tub of yogurt. It says in there 100 grams of this yogurt contains 65% of your daily dose of sugar. That's what it says. So very clever packaging, because you look at this yogurt and you go, "I'm hungry," and you eat the whole blooming yogurt. So now you've had 5 times that much. So you're well over your recommended daily dose of sugar. That's a classic example. Now, the person that wrote that on that product, they did it deliberately.
Yeah.
Didn't they? And they knew it. They knew it.
Yeah.
And that's what we're talking about here. And that's what I mean by not overcomplicating things.
Yeah.
The spinning. Yeah. Hmm. And there's tougher ones as well. I mean... You know, when I was in IT, we were offering out products to our customers that were full of software bugs. And I was being asked to not divulge the fact that those bugs were in there. It's just wrong.
Is that a criminal offence now?
No, it's not. No, offense? No. Yeah, I'm sure there are some things that get done that are very much criminal offences, but yeah. Okay, so how do we explore this in meditation? Well, the clue here is that speech starts with thought. And lo and behold, when we meditate, thoughts come up. So we can simply look at those thoughts and ask ourselves about the nature of them. You know, look at how they would potentially contribute to speech. What would come out? Let them go. But do notice. All of this is about the noticing. You know, mindfulness isn't about shutting our minds down and pushing thoughts away. It's about noticing the nature of thoughts and the way they contribute to our lives, asking ourselves whether they're wholesome or not. We're going to do a nice mindfulness of breathing upstairs. We're going to still ourselves, so we'll be, and don't worry, I will be talking you through this, so it will be a led meditation. We'll do a body scan, then come to the breath, use the word still to settle ourselves down, and then we're going to let go of the word. And in the second part of the meditation, what I want you to do is just lift your internal gaze up a little, as if you're looking out towards the moon, if you like, and just sit and keep focused on the breath, but just become aware of the nature of the thoughts that are going through your head, what's coming through, noticing if any of those are speech related. A lot of them tend to be. Different people have different types of thought. I am very dialogue oriented. There's lots of chatter that goes on in my head. Some people are very visual. Visuals, they can also lie. They can be harsh. So look at everything. Just take a moment to look at the mental object as it arises and study it, and then let it go. Come back to the breath. See what comes up next. Okay. So let's settle down and just gently close your eyes and just tune into your experience of the space around you, first of all. So let the sounds come to you near and far. Feel the space. Feel the ground supporting you underneath. And awareness of friends sitting with you. Take a couple of nice deep breaths. Just relax yourself. Breathing into a compassionate heart. Establishing your motivation for practice. We'll start with our little Buddhist mantra. Feel free to join in if you wish to, or just listen. Namo Buddhaya, Namo Dhammaya, Namo Sanghaya, Namo Nama, Am Hum. And we'll start with the body scan. So take your minds into your feet. And gently experience the sensations there as much as you can possibly feel. Tuning in, tiny little sparks of energy. Temperature. And contact with clothing or with the ground. Work across the soles of the feet, feeling as much as you can as you go. Up over the heel, and working up through the ankle bones. Into the shins and the calf muscles. And as you travel, explore for tension and just soften it. Any aches and pains, try to breathe into them, let go of the tension associated with them. Into the knees, and working through along thighs, hamstrings, into the sitting bones, sinking into the seat. And as you sink and settle, just allow the head to float up a little and feel the spine stretching and becoming stronger. Strength coming into your posture. And with that, a freshness in the mind. And we can use that freshness to establish a sense of strong intent to stay with practice. To practice that self-discipline. We take our minds into the stomach and heart space and discover our emotions. Don't try to follow the stories of the emotions, the thoughts behind them. Just look at the raw result, the physical experience of the emotion. What's going on? How do you feel? And we bring our awareness up to our shoulders, noticing tension, we let it go. Let it melt out. We let our awareness travel down the arms, into the hands and the fingers. back up to the head and gently explore the scalp for any sensations you can find. Temperature, gentle tingling, whatever's going on. When we come to our faces, imagine a compassionate gaze, gazing out on someone or something you love. That gaze is behind the eyes. It softens the muscles around the eyes, eases out the frown. Gentle smile on the lips. We bring all these sensations together, sitting in this space with friends. Our life in this moment, right now, we celebrate with the breath. Anapanasati, mindfulness of breathing. Have your internal gaze downcast, first of all, slightly below the horizon. And bring your awareness to the breath wherever you feel it most. And as you gently breathe, on each out-breath, hear the word still echo in the mind and settle in the body. Focusing on the breath, bringing a sense of concentration into the practice. Just the breath, still. Just the breath. Let thoughts go. Still. Fully present with the breath. Nothing else matters right now. Still. letting go of the word, still with your awareness on the breath, lift your internal gaze as if you're looking up into the sky. Notice the effect it has on your mental state. See how you feel. And with that awareness still on the breath, just notice mental objects as they appear. What's their motivation? Where they come from? If they were to transpire and become speech, what would be their nature? What are the thoughts like? Are they wholesome? Notice and then let them go. Awareness on the breath. a thought arises in the mind, and if we allow it to, it becomes a word. These words collect and become actions. Actions develop into habit, and habit hardens into character. Each and every thought is contributing to our character. So we should ensure they arise out of a place of compassion and love for all beings. We soften our concentration and offer ourselves a silent intent to take this practice out into our day. Like ripples in a pond, we make a difference. Om Mani Padme Hum. And when you're ready, open your eyes and bring your meditation to an end.